Everyone, and welcome to Minute 36 of Season 10 of Movie Our Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Andy Golding of Blueprint Review and of the former Spoiler Podcast. Welcome to the show, Andy. It's great finally getting you.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, it's fantastic to be here. I've been wanting to come on for a while, and you've had some of my favourite podcasters on before, so I'm honoured to be part of it.
Oh, you're talking about my guests, not me. I get it. Okay.
Well, that goes without saying. You're the man in the chair.
That's fine. I'm glad that my guests are what bring in other guests. Isn't that the point? That's what. No, I'm saying that serious. I'm being completely sincere about that. I like getting new guests, you know. And what better way to get new guests is via other guests. That's the way you do it. You know, you want to make sure that you're not going to get a lemon. So hopefully you're not a lemon.
Well, know? We'll see.
we'll find out over the course of the week. You know, whether I'm going to want to invite you back in the future or not. We'll see if you behave. You know. Or if you just act like Mr. Green, well, then we'll have to maybe put you in the back of the train. We'll have to wait and see.
On that topic, I should say, I do have a plan for this week. Each episode, at some point in the episode, I'm going to say the words, "I'm taking your train." And at that point, for a minute or two, I'm hijacking the podcast and we're going to do something that I've planned for a couple of minutes. So that's a bold gambit for a first-time guest, but... All thematically, right. It's on point. So.
Do I need to be prepared?
I'm prepared.
I don't have $1 million to give you. So, you know, what's 17 votes anyway? Yeah. So, I don't know. All right. So, why don't we just start from the beginning then? What is your history with this movie? I know that when I contacted you, you were so excited that you were being invited onto this particular movie. And so, obviously, you do have a history about it. And I'd like to know what that history is.
I first heard of this film when I was a teenager. I heard the critic Mark Kermode talking about it on the radio. And it was a film that I've never heard of before. And it was on TV not long after that. So I watched it. And I just loved it straight away. And I think back then, it was even more of a hidden gem than it is now. I think its reputation has built up quite a bit over the years, but it still doesn't seem to have quite reached that same level of the classics that everyone talks about. But in those days, I really felt like I was watching a hidden gem that not many people knew about. So I immediately bought myself a copy, and I've watched it loads down the years and just recommended it to everyone I ever met, pretty much. I don't know how many of them watched it or if they were as enthusiastic about it as I am, but
they've missed out.
Absolutely, yeah. I've never watched either of the remakes. One of them was on TV here recently, actually, and I thought, shall I watch it for the podcast just something extra to bring to the podcast? And I couldn't quite bring myself to do it. I didn't want another version of the story.
Because I've been talking so disparagingly about them? Or
well, yeah, partly. I've been listening along to the episodes, and I don't think I've heard anyone who's been a fan of either of the remakes yet.
Yeah. Again, the one from 98 has some good things in it, but it's too similar to the original. They make one of the hijackers a woman, and they have some nice casting choices there, but other than that, it's not really anything. It's not groundbreaking, obviously. And the 2009 version, as much as I like Travolta and Denzel, they tried turning this into something else. You know, and I think one of the reasons that this movie works so well is the low-key look and feel of the characters. And when you put Denzel and Travolta in the top roles, I mean, I'm not saying that neither Matthau or Shaw at the time were not big draws. They were, but not the same way.
Yeah. I mean, they try as you might, you can't make Denzel not look like a movie star. And Walter Matthau never really looked like your average movie star, but he looks, you can drop him into so many different roles, and I absolutely believe that he's Garba here.
Yeah.
And Shaw as well. I mean, Robert Shaw, we'll talk about him more in the coming days, but it's he's a versatile actor.
Yes.
And so he's immediately, however you whatever garb you put him in, he seems to just take to it.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So, so minute 36 begins with Kaz making himself very clear and ends with Patron not really being able to hear. So we left things on Friday with Kaz shouting at Mr. Gray. And Mr. Gray is just acting like Mr. Gray. You know, anyone who's seen the movie knows that he continues to act this way throughout the entire movie. You know, he doesn't change. But
no, I think it would be a surprise. It would be a hard twist to sell, I think, if he suddenly backpedaled on his on his particular attitudes.
Yes. But you know, I've mentioned this before. Casting Hector Elizondo in this role is just great because, you know, we know of him since then, and it's not him.
Yeah.
So you know that makes things very, very different because of that. You know, yeah, at the time in 1974, he wasn't as well known. Obviously, you know, he wasn't in every Gary Marshall film at the time.
Yeah.
So it took a little while for him to finally break through to that nice guy role, I guess you can say. But here he definitely therefore it's hard to say that he is playing against type, but he's just not what we would expect from, if you know that it's Hector Elizondo, you wouldn't expect that from him.
It's, yeah.
You know, looking.
Yeah, he's playing against type before his type was established, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So this minute basically starts with a shot of Mr. Grace looking and trying to figure out what's going on with Kaz. And we hear Kaz continue to scream, "I'm coming on board." And he just opens fire. You know, he just shoots all over the place. And, you know, Kaz just falls down. And, you know, we have all of the passenger starts screaming, and Gray then screams out, "I warned you, stupid," which is interesting.
Yeah, it did strike me. It's not the jolliest of moments for me to jump on board, is it? Yeah, straight away, I clicked on my first minute and thought, "What's going to happen?" And immediately, someone got gunned down.
Well,
Kaz, fat Kaz.
Yeah, but. The whole thing also is that there isn't, you know, there's how many people die in this movie before the end? There's only two of the passengers who get gunned down in cold blood, or two, not even passengers, two yeah. innocent people get done gunned down. The movie is more intense than it is violent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That they play it well in the way that they the order of the people that they get killed as well, because Kaz is such a force, and he's a little bit obnoxious, and so when he's killed, it's almost sort of easier to take than the next killing down the line, which they've set up to feel a bit more shocking.
Correct. But I mean, I think first time watchers are going to be shocked about the fact that Kaz gets shot here also.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's a bit more. They make it they with the later death, they've layered in a bit more detail to make it more sort of sympathetic.
Yes.
As they've made him a real force of nature, his sort of belligerence, his refusal to back down, is what gets him killed ultimately.
Yeah. Exactly. And so basically, at this point, you know, everyone's just looking around trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And, you know, we get a shot of Kaz just falling down. And, you know, then we get Officer James, who's hiding in the background. And he goes, holy shit. Because he didn't expect it. I mean, here you have this cop who's sent down to take a look at what's going on. You know, keep back a little bit. You know, we saw him a little bit, you know, last week as he's getting into position and stuff like that. That he has a great view of everything that's going on, and he just can't believe that they just shot Kaz, even though he doesn't know Kaz. He knows the supervisor went down. That was about it. And it takes a little bit of time before Blue comes running, and then he runs across the train and you know skids to a halt in front of Gray and gives him a very very stern look, and Gray just turns to him and goes, I warned the bastard, but he kept on coming anybody. He kept coming anyway. again, I don't know if one would normally think of Kaz as a threat, but it is dark. So and also Gray is trigger-happy. So I don't think.
That's what I took from it. I think Gray was. I think Gray was happy that he kept coming. I think he wanted to kill him.
Yeah, he was looking for an excuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes sense. Makes sense. And then Blue says to him, "Was he alone?" And he goes, "I didn't see nobody else." And then you know he calls Mr. Brown over to him. He goes, "Mr. Brown." And then Gray chuckles and goes, "I guess I got us on the scoreboard, right?" And he starts chuckling with that whole thing. So the word scoreboard. What do you know about the term scoreboard?
Scoreboard. I just think of it as a. I think of it first of all. I think of it in the context of sports, but also I think of it in context of game shows as well. Just like a big board where you put your scores up, basically.
Okay. How far back do you think the term goes?
How far back? Oh, now then. I can imagine it's quite a long way because they used to have those ones before we had electronic ones. Obviously, it's the ones where you put the numbers just on a hook. So I'm going to say it goes back to the late 1800s, maybe.
Okay, so it the earliest recorded known use of the term scoreboard goes back to the 1820s.
Oh, wow. Early
1800s. As opposed, and it was basically a board that was used to keep a tally of debts in a tavern. You know, they would have like a chalkboard that they would keep, you know, score or keep track of, you know, how much money people owed and stuff like that. About a decade later in the 1830s, that's when it started being used for games, where they would use the idea of keeping track, as you said, of what's going on in a game. And the original idea of the word score is that it was the practice of making notches on a piece of wood to count something. And anyone who knows American history, at least, knows what a score is. Do you know what a score is?
A score?
20 years ago.
Oh, yes. It's 20, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. Is it 20? It's 20 or something. So the idea was that you know, you'd mark 20... notches on a piece of wood, and that was known as a score.
Oh, wow. Oh, I did not know any of that.
Yeah, well, isn't that why you're here, to learn about those things?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you thought you were here to talk about the taking of Pelham 1-2-3? Come on.
I should say when we're talking about this, I guess I got us on the scoreboard line as well. I think it's beautifully punctuated by casual chewing of gum.
Yes.
I love the way Mr. Gray just chews on his gum. It shows how little he cares about this. He's cracked a joke and then he's just chewing away on his gum and he doesn't care. I think it's a low, I don't know if it was, he you're directed to do that, or if that was the actor's choice, but it's a lovely choice.
Yeah, we'll never know.
That's
one of the things about Tarkin Meta movies from 51 years ago. You know, there aren't that many people around who would be able to tell us that, unless someone knows how to get in touch with Hector Elizondo and we can ask him, you know, and hopefully he would remember. You know, he can't even guarantee.
Well, at least we can get some hard and fast facts about the term scoreboard. That makes up for it.
Exactly. I completely agree with you. I think that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, nowadays, scoreboards are electronic. They use incandescent light bulbs and things like that in order to, keep track of things. And obviously, technology has changed so much, even since the 80s, when they started doing that like 40 years ago, that nowadays, I mean, the scoreboard is completely animated and things like that. So,
yeah. And they have the little like do 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 and all the little like the tunes and the explosions and things on them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I'm guessing that's a new innovation. I'm guessing when it was used for keeping track of debts, they didn't have to emulate that in any way.
You never know. It might just be a question of how drunk people were. Maybe they were down to Vex. I was never in a pub in the 1820s or 30s, so I couldn't tell you. You know, what was really going on then? But from what I've seen in movies, you know, people would go there and they really would get drunk. So it is plausible to believe that, you know, people are making sound effects.
I'm going to believe that. I choose to believe that.
That's right. I choose to believe that too. There you go. I think that works. Yes. And, you know, after he makes this joke, so once again, we hear the hostages screaming and some of them are crying and stuff like that, because you know they're now as much as they've been joking up until now, the hostages now realize that you know, these men mean business, even though again we know it's only Mr. Gray, not anybody else. But and then Mr. Blue turns to Mr. Brown and goes, "You take over from Mr. Gray, all right?" And then he begins to stutter and goes, "He's a little quick with that gun." And then Greg goes, "What do you mean? That little jerk was coming on board. What are you talking about?" You know, very, very defensive with the whole thing. And did you catch the line that Mr. Brown said? He loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I see Gray, definitely. That's how I see Gray. I think he did love every minute of it.
Yeah.
In fact, I think it's... I think you talked previously about the name Green for the most amateur member of the hijacking, how he's Green.
Yes.
And I often think of Gray as an ironic name for this character, because he's the least morally gray character of all of them.
Ah, very good. Yeah, that's pretty good. Now we should think of how Blue and Brown fit in.
Yeah.
Think of reasons to why they. So he calls Kaz a jerk, which I actually find very funny, because you would think that a character like Mr. Gray would have used a more colorful metaphor.
Yeah.
As opposed to just calling him a jerk. So do you have any idea about the term jerk? Where that comes
from? No, I mean the only thing that springs instantly to mind is a masturbatorial reference.
Okay, that wasn't where we were going. But thank you for bringing that up, Andy. yes, I definitely wasn't going in that direction.
that wasn't my attempt to hijack the podcast.
I'm glad.
That's not a direction I want to take it in, to be honest.
Definitely not. So the slang term of jerk goes back to the 1930s. And basically what it means, it's either an inept, pathetic, foolish, or a failed person.
Oh, okay.
And going along with what you were talking about with the masturbatory aspects of it, so the phrase jerking off was a reference to the idea of someone who is basically inept, pathetic, foolish, failed, and therefore needs to be on his own.
Oh, okay.
So there is a connection there, you know, from
there
from
is a connection there, yeah.
Yes.
The guy seemed it was just the description of the movement. I don't know if I want to maybe dig any deeper into this. Yes. Really,
well, again, there's back in the
there's 30s, a jerking movement as well. So.
That's correct, and which is why in the 1940s there was the term a soda jerk. You know, back to my season where we talked about It's a Wonderful Life. So there was, you know, that was his job. He was a soda jerk. And the idea of calling someone a soda jerk was because they were operating a soda fountain handle, and by jerking it, that was the jerking motion that they would do in order to dispense, the drinks. And therefore, they would call them a soda jerk.
So that was in the 40s, that term, was it? And
yes.
Jerk came in as an insult in the 30s.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now,
so,
I think it would be connected to that because people also... In a lot of movies we see, because again, I wasn't around in the 20s, 30s, and 40s to see what was going on with in drugstores where people were serving chocolate sodas or ice cream sodas or whatever. But I think it was also a derogatory way of thinking of these people. Again, you can then even think about the movie The Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Where, that type of job is looked down upon, even by someone who's doing the job. You know, so
yeah.
I guess that would also fit in there. But nowadays it means something completely different. Okay, the term evolved over time, and it's now usually referring to someone who's either obnoxious, rude, or selfish. Okay, selfish still fits in with what we were talking about before.
Yeah,
but
because the Steve Martin film The Jerk, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought
he's not
really a jerk in the way you'd say now, is he? Although he is calling himself a jerk, isn't he? That's where that title comes from. But
yes,
he's mm-hmm. not selfish, rude, or
no,
or ignorant. He's just a bit foolish.
Yes, that is true. He's very foolish. Again, he's. Pathetic.
Yeah, a bit was selling it short.
You know, it fits in. I think it fits in. But he eventually turns into an obnoxious person also in the movie.
That's true.
Once he becomes rich. So, you know, maybe that's connected there also.
That's true. And by the time he's calling himself a jerk, that has already happened, hasn't it? So yeah, it works both ways.
Yes, definitely does. You know, these guys are we can see once again that they're really not getting along very well with this whole thing. Blue certainly has realized that he's made a mistake by bringing Gray along. You know, and at this point, Blue then leaves Brown, you know, to watch the back of the train, and then he rushes back towards the front. And, you know, the kids, the two boys, are making a lot of noise, and he just... screams at them and goes, and screams at the mother and says, "Keep those children quiet." And she goes, "I'm trying, I can't." And he goes, "Do you want me to try?" And she goes, "Oh my God, no."
Yeah, this was interesting to me because I was thinking there's levels of villainy here, and it plays on the audience's sympathies because Gray is the one that we hate the most, or it's the one that I felt hate most hatred towards. But then this moment, Blue just openly threatens two children right there, right to the mother. Blue's villainy tends to be a bit more calculated, but he seems to be he's tipping his hand a bit here because he's showing that he's losing control of the situation in this outburst.
Correct. I mean, we did talk about a few weeks ago the fact that he was talking about that there are 2 minutes behind, meaning that he has this everything completely planned out. And my assumption is that Blue's original plan was that this would be a complete cakewalk and that nobody would get injured. They would get their $1 million and that would be it. I don't think, again, he's prepared to act violently, but I believe he doesn't. He has convinced himself that's not going to that there's not going to be a need for that.
Yeah, and he's convinced Green of that as well, hasn't he?
For sure, and well, obviously he knows that he has to convince Green of that. That goes without saying.
Yeah.
You know, Green
Yeah.
wouldn't come along if they said, "Yeah, well, we're going to kill half the passengers." You know, so yeah, no, that's not a thing. And you know, he goes to the front of the train and meets up with Green, and Green then says to him, "Oh, you said nobody's going to get hurt," and he just gives him a look, which is also, as you said, a very telling look you know, his plan is starting to unravel here a little bit, because of the fact that for whatever reason, he has hired Gray to be part of this this heist. Now, I've asked almost all my guests this question, so now I will ask you this question too. Since do you think that Blue is the front man for everything that is going on? Like, he has set up everything, or do you think this is like a Reservoir Dogs type of thing where, you know, you have someone like Joe who has planned this whole thing, and he's hiring Blue to be the guy who's implementing the plan?
The impression I always got is that Blue was the one who was implementing it. I always thought Blue was the one who was in control. That's why when Green turns to him and says, I thought you said nobody would get hurt, that gives me the impression that he's the one who was giving them all the instructions, and he's the only one that they've kind of dealt with. But I suppose there could be someone higher up who's only dealt with Blue, and then Blue has disseminated that information down.
Correct. No, that's what I think. I think it's more like that Blue was hired,
yeah,
to put together a team, or he was told, okay, these are the guys you're going to have on your team, and then, you know, they put them all together. Because, you know, the one of the biggest questions that one asks when watching this movie, when diving into it like we're doing it, is that, you know, how did Blue get involved with Gray? You know, like, where would he find him? It wasn't the guy, like, it, the relationship that we see between Blue and Brown makes it seem as if they've worked together in the past.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, we don't know. This is all pure speculation, and Green is the guy that they brought along because he knows trains, and he apparently has the idea of how, you know, to get over the dead man switch. That's the whole thing. But then the question is okay, where does Gray fall in here? I mean, did
the only thing I could think of,
you know,
yeah, I thought maybe Gray hid that side of himself until they got down there. But then I'm not convinced that Gray has that much self-control to portray himself in a different way.
No, but last week the comment was made, I think by Brown, if I remember correctly, that, you know, I think he was kicked out of the mafia. So
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Not really sure. And then the shot changes, and we're now back with Patrolman James, who is completely still in shock as to what's going on. And he pulls out his radio and starts, you know, calling into it. And he goes, "Patrolman James, calling operations." And then we hear Patron, and it's really loud. He goes, "This is Patron. Did you find that supervisor?" And James then says into the radio, "Shh," which is pretty funny that he's trying to shush him, you know, through the radio for the whole thing. I mean, we see that he does turn down the volume and stuff like that, but it's just very, very funny the way that's done.
I think if you heard that noise coming through a radio, you'd just think it was static.
Yeah, probably. Especially back in the 1970s.
Yeah.
You know, and Patron also is very nonchalant by the way that he's asking all this stuff. You know, he's not very involved in this. You know, he goes, "Hey, did you find that supervisor?" You know, he doesn't sound concerned at all. You know, I sent you to go find the supervisor. Did you find him? You know, that's about it. And then he whispers very loudly into his walkie-talkie and goes, "He's dead, Lieutenant." And then Rico screams and says, "Speak out, will ya? I can't hear ya." which I think is a perfect place for this minute to end. You know, to keep us in suspense as to what's going to happen along the way. with this whole thing. So, I like the way that Patron responds to the whole thing. It's and I've always loved Jerry Stiller, so you can't complain about that. All right, did you have anything else you wanted to say about this particular minute?
I don't think so. The only other note I've got is that I really like the character of Patrolman James. I always really liked him when I first saw it, and I love the way that this film has so many different perspectives that it can flip between.
Yes.
So it's, even though you have got Garber as the main protagonist and Blue as the antagonist, we go to so many different characters for so many different perspectives. I love the way that it works like that.
And it's all done in plausible ways. It's not like they're just giving us, like a hidden video camera somewhere.
No.
It's where they place the characters and stuff like that, which is great. That's what I love about that. Yeah. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Mathow Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Mathau performances. So why don't you start off with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, well, at this point, Rob, I'm going to say the words, "I'm taking your train." Because I love Walter Matthau so much that I couldn't pare it down. So I've actually done a top 10. So I'm hijacking the podcast for my top 10 Matthau. I've ranked them, so we
Okay,
will get a
you can
top
do that. I have no problem with it. I'm only going to count the top five, but you can, only the top five are going to get points. But feel free
Yeah,
to
sure.
give me your top ten.
Okay. Oh, also, something that I kind of I took the Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3 as read as being one that I loved. So I haven't included that as in any of my lists. So I'm just taking that as read that it's a great film, and that way I could get more in.
Okay,
So I'm
then
doing it by
that's
performance.
completely fair to do, but you do realize that that means you're going to be taking away points from Pelham 1, 2, 3. That's what it comes.
Well, I'm pretty sure Pound 1, 2, 3 is gonna get all the points. So I'll go with that.
Okay,
So
fair.
I could bump one actually. Let's put Pelham in. Let's put Pelham in. I'm gonna put
Okay, so you're getting
Pelham
your top 11.
in. No, I'm gonna put Pelham in. There we go. I'm putting Pelham in. So I'm gonna bump. I did have a face in the crowd, the Alakazam film at number 10, but Matthau's a very small part in that, really. It's a pivotal role, but it's a smallish role. And I've really ranked them by how much I like the performance.
Okay,
So I
that
will
was
bump
your
that.
assignment.
That was yeah that that's my that so that was my number 10. So that we'll bump that down. So my new number 10 then is House Calls, which is the rom-com by Howard Zeef. It's a I've never seen it before. I watched it in the run up to this because it didn't have a lot of love, really. Not many people seem to think it's great, but I thought it was a quite a charming little film, and I really enjoyed it. My number 9 is Elaine
I've actually
Mayes
seen it,
in
and
A New Leaf.
I enjoyed it a lot. House Calls.
House Calls, I'd never really heard of it much. It was doing this Mathau deep dive that I heard of it and found out that there was a 3-season sitcom that was based on it as well, starring Wayne Rogers. I don't know if you've ever seen any of that.
No, I've never seen the TV show, but I did see this movie, and the thing that always gets me about it is you don't think of Walter Matthau as a romantic lead.
No.
He was in so many movies where he was the romantic lead. It just doesn't make sense. But
Well,
it's great.
in that particular film, he's actually highly sought after by women as well. He's fending them off.
That's right.
Number 9. Number 9 is A New Leaf, the Elaine May film. I think a few people have chosen that so far. It's I really like Elaine May, and she's got a very short filmography as director, but and I think Matthau's great in that. I do think Elaine May does steal it from him. I think she's the funniest thing in that film. But I wanted that in there. Okay, so next is The Odd Couple. I haven't seen it for a long, long time, but it is a great film. So I went with the Odd Couple there. The next is Lonely of the Brave, which I hadn't seen before until the run up to this podcast, but I watched it and I really liked it. It's Matthew again. He's not in it for a long time, but then his role picks up in the back end of it, and it's a nice little role for him. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I've
So
been
the
meaning to
one,
rewatch that one.
yeah, I remember you said you weren't so keen the first time you
That's
saw
right.
it, were you?
That's right. And I still haven't had a chance to rewatch it since week two.
Okay, so something's getting bumped now. So the one that would have been in my top five, which has just been bumped, is Failsafe, the Sidney Lumet film. It tends to live in the shadow of Doctor Strangelove because it was the same year and the same topic of nuclear Armageddon, basically. But Sidney Lumet's film takes a far more serious look at things, and it's one of Matthau's best straight roles, I think. So going to the top five then, number five is a film that I love, King Creole, the Michael Curtiz Elvis Presley film, in which Matthau plays the villain, and I think he just makes a really great villain. He's so slimy in it. It's so good. And also you get to see Walter Matthau have a fight with Elvis Presley. I mean, how many films are you going to say that about?
That's
So
true.
I put that in there. Michael Rich's Bad News Bears then is my number four. It's just a great schlubby role for Walter Matthau. It fits him. I was gonna say it fits him like a glove, which is a terrible dad joke, but I didn't mean it like that for a
Yes.
baseball film. I don't know if anyone, so far from the guests I've heard, I haven't heard anyone pick this one. But my number three is Charlie Varrick, which is the Don Siegel film. It was meant for Clint Eastwood, that role, but I don't think it would have been anywhere near as interesting a film had it starred Eastwood and not Walter Matthau. He gives such a good performance. He's essentially a villain in it, but he's again, it's layers, and he's a villain who accidentally steals money from the mafia. And so, I think it's a really good film. It's surprising how few people have seen Charlie Varrick, but I
Okay,
really
well,
enjoyed that.
spoiler alert for you, and not for anyone who's listening right now. There was a guest after the episodes that you're talking about who ranked it as
Yeah.
number one.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Oh, I look forward to hearing talk about that. So then, which formerly my number one, is The Fortune Cookie, which was Matthau's Oscar-winning performance, and Billy Wilder's The Fortune Cookie is the unscrupulous brother-in-law lawyer. I think that was his first film with Jack Lemmon as well. I think that was the first film to pair Matthau and Lemmon,
I do believe
and
so.
he's just great in it. I think so. And he's great. I think he earned his Oscar. It's a really good performance. But yeah, if we're including Pelham, I can't look past it. I love this performance as Garber, so Pelham is going to be my number one.
All right, excellent. That doesn't surprise me at all. All right, and again, one of the things I mentioned this numerous times. One of the reasons I love his performance here is because of the way that his character both takes things seriously and jokes at the same time.
It's a perfect role for him because it plays to his strengths as a dramatic and comedic actor.
That's right, and we're going to see that through the course of this week. There's a
Yeah.
lot of moments where he's going to be making comments and you're like, what? Why would someone do that? Now we know. All right, that is a great list. Thank you very much for giving that to us. So
Okay.
every day we also have a game which we will play, which is called Name That Remake, where I will give you a brief synopsis of a movie, I will tell you the year the original came out and the year that the remake came out, and you have to try and guess what the movie is. All right, so let's
Okay.
spin the wheel because I do not know what movie we will be talking about. Randomly spinning the wheel, trying to figure out what movie is going to be the first one that Andy needs to talk about. Okay. This is a movie that originally came out in 1941 and was remade in 1978. Okay. And
Okay.
the idea, the premise of the movie is that a man gets into an accident and is accidentally taken by an angel and is then put back into a different body in order to potentially
Okay, yeah.
continue his life.
This is Here Comes Mr. Jordan slash Heaven Can Wait.
Very good. Excellent. Yeah. Now, which of the do you like better? Do you like the original or the remake?
I much prefer Here Comes Mr. Jordan. I've never been a big fan of Heaven Can Wait, really.
Okay. See, I agree. I think the original is much better, but I do like the spin that Warren Beatty decided to do with the story. You know, of making him a
Is it?
sports hero and changing things around a little bit from that perspective.
It
But
is.
I
It
think
is one that I should revisit, really, because I've only seen it once, I think, and it was. It seems to be a film that it had a lot of Oscar nominations, I seem to remember,
Yes.
and it seems to be a film that is kind of fallen off the radar a little bit.
But again, it's it works.
Yeah.
So, and again, it's one of the rare occasions where both the original and the remake were nominated for Best Picture. So,
Oh, they were, weren't they? Yeah, of course.
yes. All right. So, Andy, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Andy Golding?
Yes, well, I used to appear on a podcast called Spoiler, which was a film podcast where we talked about films, books, and TV shows in their entirety. You can find all the episodes of that at spoilerpodcast.podbean.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And I'm currently a writer for Blueprint Review, which is at blueprintreview.co.uk. I review new upcoming releases, and also, as I probably showed with my Walter Matthau list there, I'm a big fan of doing lists. So I do a lot of articles ranking films and directors and things. So you can find my lists of things like the best pictures, best picture Oscar winners ranked, and things like that, all on Blueprint Review.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on the website moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So, until tomorrow, achoo.
Gesundheit.